Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to Just Wanna Quilt, a research podcast coming out of Tulane University Law School, where we explore all kinds of things. Stories about quilting, tools, field trips, maybe some famous quilters stop by, and of course, a little bit of copyright thrown in just for fun. I'm Elizabeth Townsend-Gard, your host, and I just wanna quilt. So today, I'm super psyched. We are talking to Scott Fortunoff. He is a fourth generation fabric person. His family owns a variety of different fabric companies all under one rubric, Jaftex. Jaftex is also the company that is purchasing Free Spirit. Free Spirit is the company that has Tula Pink and a bunch of other really famous designers and quilters. And they just announced a few days ago that they'll be purchasing Free Spirit, including all the people that are already there. Jaftex is a super interesting company. The fabric lines include Henry Glass, Studio E Fabrics, The Blank Quilting Company, Fabric Editions, and A.E. Nathan. So we interviewed Scott about a week before the announcement. So we are very, very interested in having him back to tell us about how that all happened. And here's the interview to get to know a little bit more about Scott and his company, who are now going to be taking over Free Spirit.
This is Scott Fortunoff. I'm in New York City, 49 West 37th Street on the 14th floor.
So tell me your first memory of someone sewing or quilting in your life.
Oh, man. Well, can I answer a different question? The first time I heard about fabric?
Sure.
Well, I mean, when I was a kid growing up, my dad would bring homework home, and during the summers we would work in the office. So, but back then the business was really more manufacturing and not sewing. Sewing really, to be honest, was probably closer to when I came into the business about around 10, 12 years ago.
Interesting.
That was really when it was more about sewing and quilting.
Okay, so let's go back to when you're a kid. What did they make you do? So I had to work in, my dad still is an attorney, and I remember having to go into the office and photocopy and do all kinds of ridiculous things. I must have been like 8. I was always told how fun it was to get me to do ridiculous things. What did you do when you went to the office as a kid?
Well, back in those days, we used to have a sample room. Definitely worked with the sample people. Did some like order entry things, you know, more clerical, whatever they needed me to do, sort of stuff. A lot of paperwork.
Yeah.
Going to appointments, things like that.
Interesting.
One actually interesting thing, I'll try to sneak the interesting stuff in. When I was in high school, about 10th or 11th grade over the summer, my dad, at that time, we had two plants that we owned in the Carolinas, and my dad sent me for the summer to work at the plants. My brother did the same thing. He wanted us to see that, you know, it's not all about being spoiled living in New York, and there are other people, and, you know, when you call down to the plant and say, can you do this and do that, there are actual people doing it. And he just wanted me to kind of see from the ground up what went on, and that's a totally different perspective, and it certainly was eye-opening, to say the least.
So for people that might not know who you are, you come from a family of people who manufactured, sold fabric, and all kinds. You're a fourth generation textile person,
yep.
Is that right?
And we're almost 90 years old.
Amazing.
Right.
So
yep.
Tell me, how does it feel to be part of that? Like, did you always know you were going to go into the family business, or did you try to like escape? Like, what's your, if they were making a movie of your life, what would the movie be?
Well, it's a very controversial subject in my family, because my brother, who's my brother's older than me, he went to Syracuse and loved the stock market, but he came into the business for a very brief stint, and then he did all this other stock market stuff, and then he came into the business about 3 years ago. So he came back. For me, you know, I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do when I went to college, but it was senior year. And I remember calling my parents and saying, all right, I think it's time for me to come to the business. I was excited. And then, you know, I went out with my friends. Next day I come home and my mom is calling me on the phone telling me, you know, business has been tough. But a lot of this is when the manufacturing was going to China. And long story short, I ended up going to law school.
You did? Oh, that's right. We talked about this at Cardoza, right?
Yes, I went to Cardoza. So that was kind of, I always refer, I don't know if you read any of my blogs yet, but I always refer back to the road less traveled and kind of how I took the road less traveled by going to law school, but I ended up back on the same road that I probably would have gone on in the first place. Which is kind of ironic because I ended up in the family business anyhow. So, did I answer your question?
Yeah.
So I worked in law school.
So you went to law school. Did you do in law school? Did you focus on anything in particular?
More securities law was my interest at that time. Yeah, I started the Securities Law Society at my school, but I hated it. I really didn't like law school. I would like those 3 years back, but I did it. I survived. I passed the bar, and that was the end of my career. Then I went into stocks, and about 8 or 10 years into that, it was getting extremely difficult and stressful. And my dad said, "Why don't you come work in the business?"
And so, when you get that call, what does that mean to work in the business? What does that mean at that time? Like, what did you do when your dad?
So at that time we had Henry Glass selling to quilt shops, and actually at that time they sold a little bit to the chains as well. And then we had A. Nathan, which is another one of our division, and a couple other divisions that are probably gone. But so when I came in, I trained under a gentleman named Don Edwards. He was nearing in on 80, so the plan was basically he would train me for a year and change, and then kind of wean down and retire. So I was trained to run the A. Nathan division, which focused mainly on the chain stores. This is when the chain business was really amazing and big, and a lot of licensed products we offered, you know, whether it was Dora and SpongeBob or Nickelodeon and different licenses like that. So he stayed for a year. He trained me, and then I just took over A. Nathan, and I did that for a while. And then we bought Fabric Editions. That's a company in Greenville, and they had two divisions. They had a chain division and a mom and pop division. The mom and pop division was Studio E. And since I had been working with the chains, I told my dad I wanted to learn the quilt shop side because I thought that would be the future. So we took Studio E from them and we brought it up to New York, and then we developed Studio E, and I'm the president of Studio E, and then we did the same thing with Blank Quilting. We bought them, and then we moved them into our New York office, and I'm president of Blank Quilting as well. I have a lot of titles, so they don't mean that much, but they're titles nonetheless, and I guess I'm the go-to guy when one of those companies has an issue.
It's so amazing. So let's take us back. So tell me a little bit about the family. So tell me about Fabric and your family and sort of how it's sort of shifted over time. It seems like, so what we want to do with this interview is I want to understand sort of, you know, kind of a short history of Fabric and your family, and then kind of what happens now. And then I have specific ridiculous questions to ask you about. So, obviously I think there's also, you know, one of the big questions, and maybe we can even start with this, is the difference between Fabric at shops and Fabric at places like Joann's and Walmart. And you sell at both spaces, right?
Right.
So how are they different? Because there's all this sort of talk about that, of like, where do you buy your fabric and how is it different? And I'm really curious what your thoughts are about that.
Well, why don't I take you back a little bit, since you're No offense. I think you're a little bit new to this.
Yeah.
Back in the day when I started, companies who now sell to quilt shops only sold to the chains and to quilt shops. So basically there was the chains and the quilt shops, but more or less what was happening was Walmart or Joann's would be selling the fabric for two, you know, they'd be buying it at whatever price and selling it, let's say at, you know, $350 a yard. And the quilt shops were paying $325 a yard to buy it and then resell it at $6 or $7.
But
so
was it the same fabric or were they making?
Yes, in some cases it was the same products.
Really?
So finally the quilt shop said, you know, this is nonsense. We this doesn't work for us.
Yeah.
And then at that time the dichotomy had developed where we separated, you know, you either sell to quilt shops or you sell to chains. And there are companies like A. Nathan and our other division, Fabric Additions, they both sell to both, but everyone knows. You know what you're getting into. You know that if you buy it, it's potentially in one of the chains as well, but you're okay with it. You think you could still sell it.
Yeah.
Or the prices have changed up a little where they're a little bit closer now. But that was the big sticking point. Like a lot of the quilt shops were saying, you know, we can't compete with them. This is nonsense. So then we said, all right, this is it. We're quilt shops only, no more chains. So now Henry Glass, Studio E, and Blank Quilting do not sell to any of the U.S. chains.
Why?
Because of the pricing issue. Because, pricing, you know, issue. They buy such volume. You know, a quilt shop buys a bolt of every, you know, a group, 10 pieces in a group. Walmart buys 10 pieces of the group for, you know, 3,000 stores, and they're obviously getting much better pricing.
Right.
And the quilt shops can't compete with that.
Can't compete. And why
is it's really just a pricing thing.
Got it. And why is it important to have, like, it seems like Walmart's an easier relationship and customer in the sense of you're dealing with one person and 3,000 shops versus, like, 3,000 shops and three different, you know, different people in each shop. So why be in that market as well as the big box stores?
Oh man!
Is that a hard?
You know what? Listen, I'm in the business to sell fabric. I want to try to sell it to everyone I can.
Right.
You know, and listen, the chains have become extremely challenging to work with.
Interesting.
They know the pricing now. In the past, they didn't really know the pricing.
Yeah.
So there's really no leverage. I mean, if you're okay making potentially a low margin, maybe even something in the single digits.
Yeah.
Which you know you have to decide if that's worth it in the end,
yeah.
Because there are costs of doing business with them. You know, they ask you to do a lot of things, a lot of work. You know, they try to transfer the work onto you. The quilt shops, we get a better margin. We have the risk is more spread out. You know, if one quilt shop goes out of business, so maybe they stick us for $5,000. That would be a lot. But, you know, Walmart says we're out. You know, we got Hancock Fabrics. They went out of business twice. And we got stuck with hundreds of thousands of dollars in losses because, you know, so it's, you know, the good and the bad of working with the chains, you know,
yeah.
If they're healthy and they're ordering from you and paying decent prices, you're fine.
Yeah.
You know, but the other side is, you know, nowadays the prices they're paying are lower and they're very aggressive and they want a lot of concessions. And, you know, I mean, I feel like the few that are left are you know, you got Joann's, Walmart, Hobby Lobby. Michael's dabbling a little bit. So that's kind of where we're at. I mean, we lost a lot of big customers along the way, and it's always changing, you know, when new, you know, chains go away and then you have something like a fabric.com who was bought by Amazon or a Missouri Star who comes in and really, you know, they're innovators and disruptors is the word I'm looking for.
Do you see that Craftsy.com being a disruptor too?
Craftsy, we don't sell to them. They're more controversial because they're almost like selling to the chains. They really anger the quilt shops, so we tried to stay away from them.
Super interesting. So what I find so fascinating, and again, we have to go back to the do the other questions, but what I think is so interesting is that the industry still has. I mean, you have the big box stores, but the fact that these are just little shops that's the business, that there's all these different little shops with different personalities. Why do you think that has happened? Like, why hasn't there been like a group coming in to have, you know, franchised quilt shops that we're staying in this kind of very mom and pop industry across the board? Do you have any idea about that?
It's a good question. You know, listen, there are customers, like there's Beverly's. Beverly's is out of California. She has like 15 stores, or maybe she's going down these days because I think California was really struggling badly. I'm not really sure, you know. Yeah. I guess it's kind of – maybe, to be honest, it's the reason why people are against like a Walmart these days because there's no one there to cut. When a quilt shop, you get that personal help and someone who is a quilter and they could say, hey – you know, you should try this or do that. Yeah. Maybe that's why. In a chain setting, I don't know if you're going to be able to pick the person's brain who's cutting the fabric for you and saying, you know, what would you do with this? Or, you know, things like that. So yeah. I think maybe that's why it's really more of like a custom thing because every quilt is unique.
Yeah, and I don't know. I think it's fascinating. I think it feels like it's, you know, with the guilds are so important. It's got this kind of old timey, like it harkens back to its history pretty strongly, while still being super hyper capitalist and you know have all these other things and quilt market and all. You know, it's exploded right in the last since 78 or whatever. But it's kind of interesting. That's what makes it so interesting to study, is that it's this amalgamation of all these different things.
And now it's like, now what's going to happen, like, you know, everything's happening so quickly now in every other industry, you know, and now there's spoon flour and, you know, like, is individual printing going to be the future?
Right.
Are all these companies, you know, I don't know. Am I going to be here in 10 years? I don't know. And that's definitely a concern.
Yeah. It's craziness. Okay. So, let's go back. Let's tell the story of your family real quick, so people understand sort of who you are and sort of what your family does.
Starting when?
From the beginning. From the beginning, like the quick version of from the beginning. How about that?
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details. With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Oh, man. Okay, so basically my great-grandfather was, you know, jobbing, you know, buying odd lots.
Just a second. So what is jobbing? Because I read that and I have no idea what that means.
He basically would be buying, you know, what... inexpensive stuff, scraps, ends, you know, bad printings, and he would resell that. And there are still jobbers out there today, guys, you know, who are selling, you know, fabric at, you know, I'll sell you a million yards at 50 cents, you know, stuff like that. Where they're just kind of movers and, you know, bottom feeders, I guess. They would be just selling the odds and ends. And there is a market, you know, people are looking, you know, not all the fabric that is sold and used is on an outside of a garment. For example, we used to sell to the casket trade, where they would just put the fabric inside the caskets, just to, you know, so the casket would be soft and comfy. You know, so there is, you know, a use of fabric, you know, inexpensive fabric for other things. You know, some people are doing a lot of charity stuff, so they want to buy something as inexpensively as possible, but they want to make a blanket that could keep someone warm who they don't really care what it looks like. They just need to be warm because they're trying to survive.
Yeah. Okay, so your great-grandfather was jobbing, and then what happened?
He was jobbing, and then he had relatives in the business with him, and then he kind of went out on his own and did his own thing, and he continued to job and sell flannel and get involved in all kinds of women's sleepwear. A lot of different areas of the women's sleepwear And pajamas, you know, like I know growing up, I mean, my dad used to bring home pajamas and nightgowns for my mom. And, you know, like, for example, we had a business that did the cuffs. So we did the, you know, the little cuffs on the end of a pajama pants.
Oh, how interesting.
So all different, a lot of different pieces. So we had a lot of different companies. All the companies had, you know, someone's initials, my dad and his cousin. My grandfather and his brother, my aunt, and they did all these different parts of the pajamas and women's sleepwear. And that's just where it went. And then we did that for a long time. That was probably, my grandfather, my dad, maybe a little bit of my great grandfather too. And then somewhere along the way, maybe probably about, let's see, maybe 20 years ago, we somehow got into the chain business first, selling to Walmart. That was probably with our A. Nathan division. We started selling to Walmart, and then we discovered the quilt shops and what we call it the over-the-counter business. I don't know if you've come across that term yet, mm-hmm. But that's what we're calling our industry now. Excuse me, over-the-counter fabrics. So we bought A. Nathan. We started selling the chains. Then we bought Henry Glass. We started selling the quilt shops. And then it was kind of lucky. We always go back and say, you know, was my dad, did he know something was coming, or did we just get lucky to have bought the companies that sold to the quilt shops and to the chain stores? The timing was good because all of a sudden the Chinese took all the business overseas on the sleepwear because the price, we just couldn't compete with them.
That's remarkable. But you had already transitioned, so you were okay. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Interesting. All right.
Yes, so we got lucky. We always say, were we lucky or good? But it's better to be it's better to be lucky than good.
Okay. So tell me the difference between the companies we keep talking about. So you have five of them that are under your control at this point. Is that right? Am I right?
We have Studio E, Henry Glass, and Blank. Uh-huh. Sell to quilt shops only.
Uh-huh.
Then we have A. Nathan and Fabric Editions. They sell to anyone. More chains than anyone, but everyone.
So how are they different? Tell me, like, what makes one, like, do they have a particular, like, style, or like what's difference between Blank Quilting and Henry Glass, for instance?
Okay. So Henry Glass is probably our oldest quilt shop company. And they're the most well known. I would say almost, if you add Studio Blank together, their sales are just a little bit more than Henry Glass. So Henry Glass is really very well established, and they have really good licensed designers. So they have this Kim Diehl. I don't know if you've come across her name yet, but she's a big deal. But she's Diehl.
Right.
She's huge for Henry Glass. I mean, every line she does is a couple hundred thousand yards, which is really a huge line, which is amazing. And then they had Buggy Barn, who since separated. These were two sisters, but now the sisters broke off, and now it's one sister design. So they're with us. And there are just tons of names that they – like the bigger names out there.
Yeah.
And they're more in the I always forget this word. They do more the darker fabrics.
Yeah.
A little bit like the – I don't know if it's folkloric. Maybe that's not the word. But in any case, more the richer, darker designs.
Yeah.
Kim Diehl's are just very rich colors, simple, you know, nothing crazy as far as designs, but she just has a following and she shows you how to use the fabric. And people
like,
just
I'm on your web. I'm on your website now, which is if you just go to Monday, henryglassfabrics.com. You can, if you're listening, you can follow along, but Kim Diehl's is like browns and kind of earthy tones, right? Is that
right? Rich olives and burgundies and even blacks and browns.
Yeah.
Interesting. Things like that.
Yeah.
So Studio E was the next company. Studio E was really more modern as compared to Henry Glass. That's kind of how I would pinpoint it. But for Studio E, our lead designer, I'd probably say, is Pepper Corey. I don't know if you came across her, but
yeah,
she has been around for a while, had quilt shops, writes books. But she got us into the peppered cottons. Do you know about shot cottons?
No, tell me about those.
Okay, so shot cottons, this was an item, she didn't invent it or anything like that. We just came up with our own colors. Kay Fassett had been doing them, and these are shot cottons. So basically, the color in the warp and the weft are different. So it creates an effect. I could send you some samples of that.
I see it. Yeah, they're really cool.
But
yeah.
So you might have like a green and a blue. Uh-huh. And when you look at it from different angles, it has a different appearance, but it's not straight solid.
Yeah.
So it's really, really cool. More interesting.
Right. Is this the kind of the Moda grunge stuff? Is that kind of that kind of
No, thing? That's printed.
That's printed.
It's more like Kay Fassett's shot cottons.
Got it. They're really pretty.
Yeah. Yes.
Very cool. Okay. So
yes.
Studio E.
So that was Studio E.
Yeah.
So basically the important people for Studio E, I mean, definitely Pepper Corey. There's some others along the way. Sandra Magsalmon, she's an author that did these books that have like appendages that come out. So if you go to Barnes and Noble, she'll have the book about a dog and the ears will pop out of the top.
Uh-huh.
So we started doing that with fabric books, and I could send you some of those too.
Cool.
Make a list of pepper
really
cotton.
Interesting. And how do you get the designers for these? Like, tell me more about the company. There's too many things to talk about. So we've got Studio
Okay, fine. So let me just finish. So basically, I'll end that on Studio E. For Blank. Blank is new. They had a definitely a well-established company. They just ran it, poor business decisions, so that got them messed up and in financial trouble. So we bought them about 3 or 4 years ago. Their specialties were definitely their basics. They had a lot of different basics. They used also a lot of this glitter on a bunch of different fabrics,
uh-huh.
like a metallic glitter. For them right now, I would have to say that their two most important designers would be Tana Mueller of Western Denim and Dirt. She's out of Texas. She does a lot of Western theme lines that do very well for us. And then more recently, we hooked up with a woman named Hope Yoder, and she's big in the embroidery area. She does a lot of these shows where companies bring her in to help them sell their sewing machines and embroidery machines. But really, Blank is in a regroup. We're trying to find more new people who are well known in the industry to try to gain a following for them.
Interesting. And so, how important is it to have designers that have followings as part
of?
Oh,
so it's huge.
It's huge. That's huge.
I mean, for Henry Glass, it's so huge. You can't even imagine.
That it's personality and brand driven of the designers that are part of the collection.
It is a lot. And now with social media, that's playing such a huge role in promoting these people, and they're writing articles and posting, you could go and look at a post and you'll see, there's a dinky post with, five comments and 12 likes. And then there's a Kim Deal one with 500 likes and, 1,000 comments, and everyone's going crazy and sharing. And so it definitely plays a role.
Yeah.
For sure.
All right. Did we get through all the companies?
Yeah.
We did. Awesome.
Yes.
Okay. Hold on. Let me get back to my list. What do you do as president of all these companies? What does your daily life look like? This is seems like a huge task. Yeah.
What does my daily life look like?
Do you sleep?
I'm not a great sleeper. I'm up early. I try to exercise because it gets me going really well. Come in, usually around, it depends. Today I was in at 8. Sometimes I'm in at 9. I'm more of I stay late. I usually make a 6:11 train. So I leave here at around 6 o'clock. And then during the day I deal with everything. A lot of emails. We have design meetings, we have to figure out deliveries, just kind of do it all. We're not a GM. We don't have people walking around the office not doing stuff. Everyone's busy.
Yeah.
and we keep busy. I mean, I work all the time. I'm always answering emails. I'm always working on the weekends. I travel a lot. Just try to do it all. And on top of that, I blog and I write all of our newsletters, which is for Studio E and Blank. I write one every other 2 weeks. So
that's a lot
doing
of money.
24 newsletters, 52 blogs. I now have my executive Facebook page where I'm trying to keep that active and get people into it. And then I'm giving away the sewing machines, which I usually do that on the weekends. I call the people who submit requests and talk to them and see why they want a machine and if they deserve one.
Right. So tell us a little bit more about the sewing machine giveaway.
Okay. So last summer, 2017, this was when Florida and Texas were having a lot of storms and, you know, people were suffering very badly. And I don't know why, but people decided to ask me what I was going to do. And I gave it some thought and I said, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to give away sewing machines. So I contacted, excuse me for 1 second. I contacted a company, Eversewn, which is owned by Brewer, or they're connected. Brewer is a distributor that we use. And, I said, you know, could we get some machines? I'll pay for them. You could ship them. And we did it, and they gave me a good deal. And I just put out the word, and people started submitting requests. I said, you know, have you been affected by the storms? Are you dealing with the tragedy in your life? And it morphed into all different things. People who have illnesses or sick family members or autistic kids. Or in one case, there was a family where they had quadruplets, and one of the kids died. So all different sorts of requests I got, and I would read them and I'd call the people and we'd talk, and, you know, for the most part, everyone got a machine. And last year I gave away, I think it was 62 machines from the summer till about November, because I decided to take December off. And then I started again in January and I gave away 17, and now I'm up to 79 machines.
Wow. That's amazing.
So
that's amazing.
So all that I ask of the people who get the machines is that they pay it forward somehow, however they deem. And the amazing thing is all these people are suffering. They're not flush with money.
Yeah.
And they're almost always doing things for charity, which is really amazing.
Yeah.
And the only other thing I ask is that they send me photographs, because I want to feel that I made the right decision in having selected them, and I want to make sure they're using the machine. And stuff like that. So, and I like to post it, and it's a feel-good thing.
Yeah.
So I like other people to see it, and, you know, I get a lot of really nice comments, and people appreciate what I'm doing. But it makes me feel good, and, you know, when I see these pictures, it makes me smile, and I know sewing is a good thing for people.
Sewing is a good thing for people. It really
is. And it helps our industry, which, you know, I think our industry is in a little bit of a downturn and has been for a little while.
Yeah, tell me a little bit about that. You call it the sew revolution, and you're trying to make things better in your industry. Tell me what's going on and why you feel like you need to help make it better.
Well, it's kind of funny how that developed. It kind of started just because of the sewing machine thing.
Yeah.
I started thinking, you know, if I give away a lot of sewing machines, more people will be sewing, and our industry could definitely use some help right now. There's definitely too many suppliers, too many people selling fabric, just very crowded.
Yeah.
I would say not that many people are thriving in the industry. You know, people are just getting by.
Yeah.
And I would say there are probably some shops and people selling fabric and saying, geez, I wish I wasn't in this, or I'm losing money. And you know, no one wants that. You know, it's very stressful to be in a business when you're not making money. So anyway, so it kind of just, it was like the egg before the chicken. I started doing the sewing machines, and then I decided to say, hey, our industry needs help. The numbers are dwindling. I mean, I think when I came in, they were saying there were maybe 15, 20 million people sewing. And now more recently, I saw it was 7 to 10 million. So listen, I'm 45 years old. I have two boys. My brother has two boys. My sister has two girls. We definitely have the fifth generation ready.
Uh-huh.
I'll
nice to be
do
there,
what
right?
I want to do what I can to try to help the industry as well. So, you know, listen, there are a lot of positives.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
The benefits from sewing and quilting, creativity, relaxation, taking stress away, excuse me, all positive things.
Yeah. Interesting.
So, you know, listen, it's a good mission.
Yeah.
And hope, you know, I just hope more people kind of embrace it and start talking about it.
Yeah.
I'm trying. Trying so to just, do the best I can.
Those that are listening, just go out, buy more fabric. Is that our mission? Is that our goal? I mean, the funny part is that, like, we're all buying a lot of fabric, right? The stash stuff, the whole, like, how much is your stash worth is huge, right? So it's ironic because it feels like everyone's buying way too much fabric, more than they can sew, but we need to buy more.
Well, I think people are dropping out of sewing. I think that's the bigger...
I
think you're right. A lot of people do have fabric, and those people will continue to have fabric, but, you know, sometimes if you live near Hancock and we're buying fabric from them on the cheap, and maybe you're not as mobile, maybe you said, you know what, I'm done.
Yeah.
Can't do this anymore. You know, maybe those people are not as sophisticated and don't want to get on the internet and go buy from a company selling on the internet fabric. They're all old school, they're touchy-feely, and maybe they say, you know what, I'll get rid of my machine, I'll get rid of my stash, I'll find something else to do.
What about the younger generation, the sort of DIY, you know, make the crafty Gemini and all these others that are, like, promoting, do you see that as helping the industry at all? The kind of...
Absolutely. A lot of, you know, the show with... Heidi Klum, you know, a lot of a lot of people are starting to make their own stuff again and be creative and repurpose clothing or, you know, do really creative things. And I think that definitely helped. There's also the, you know, the Modern Guild, that whole movement is definitely on the rise. And that's, I think, attracting more of the younger people. But that's also part of my Sew Revolution, where I'm trying to say to people, hey, you know, go teach your kids how to do it. Go teach your neighbors. You know, your kid wants to do it. Maybe your kid could get three of their friends to come also.
Yeah.
Maybe we could get, you know, home ec classes to, you know, to come back.
It's so
funny. That's the problem.
The amount of people that I interview that start with, well, I started in home ec, is remarkable. It's about half, I would say, that say, and we don't really have that anymore, so...
Yeah, I mean, I remember going to a fabric center and buying fabric for a project that I had to make in middle school and high school. And that just isn't really around anymore. But miraculously, you know, I live in New York, and everyone, whenever I say fabric, I'm in the fabric business, people say, oh, you make clothing, oh, you make bedding, oh, you make this.
Right.
Like, they just don't get it
because
I don't think quilting is... let me put it this way. It's not as big in New York as it probably is in other places. It might be.
You guys have like one quilt shop, I think, now. There's the Gotham Quilts, but I have a theory about this. I think it's because it takes space to quilt. There's a lot of knitting shops and things like that. But I think because the price of real estate, because we spent 3 weeks in New York this last summer, and I was kind of amazed because we had done this huge 6-week trip all over the country, and we ended up in New York for 3 weeks. And I think it's space. Do you? Like, New York City doesn't quilt, really. I mean, if they do, they don't have quilt shops as much as other places, like Vermont or, you know, New Hampshire, which has...
Yeah, so... So in any case, my point being,
yeah,
like we just started seeing there's a couple places locally that are starting to do sewing classes,
yeah.
And I'm not talking about New York City. I'm talking about the suburbs.
Yeah.
But even then, I was pretty surprised, and I think I'm starting to ask more people. And as I talk to people, they're all saying, you know, a lot of people more than I expected are saying they're into sewing and quilting. Like I started asking my kids babysitters,
cool.
And I was surprised to get a lot of yeses.
Yeah. That's really
one of the other things that I did was I'm on the board of the local JCC in my town.
Uh-huh.
And for my parents, for their 70th birthdays, my siblings and I endowed a program to the JCC called the Robert and Andrea Fortunoff Arts for a Community Program, where basically I told the JCC that I would support them with fabric, and we would do all kinds of arts and crafts and things with fabric.
That's awesome.
So I also got them some sewing machines, and I was there the other night. They had a little sewing event. And I keep telling them, I said, I think you should have classes. I said,
yeah,
you know, if you build it, they will come. I think
right.
If you say we're having a class, people will come out of the
usually
woodwork, and you'll be surprised that I think there are a lot of hidden quilters out there,
yeah,
waiting to come out of their shells.
Yeah. Interesting. Super interesting.
Yeah. So that's another thing I'm kind of working on now.
Super interesting. So what role does Quilt Market and play with in your business model? And what's the role of Quilt Market in the industry?
Well, it was very important. I think it's losing its importance. You know, listen, I think I mentioned to you last week when we spoke that that Abby Glassenberg had sent me a chart showing me that in the last 5 to 10 years, the vendors have gone down by 1,000, which went from 3,000 to more or less 2,000, which is a big reduction.
Yeah.
You know what? It's very expensive to get there. The quilt shops are not going there as much anymore because it's too expensive for them to come. They can't afford to be out of the shop. And they're just seeing more of the same. You know, because all the companies are trying to dumb it down and save themselves money, they're not showing enough as much creativity as in the past, where a lot of the quilt shop owners would come and get their ideas. I mean, now you could go sit at home and go on social media and look at everyone's websites and Facebook and Instagram.
Yeah.
And all the ideas are there, and you got to stay home. You didn't have to travel to, you know, Portland, Oregon, and pay for a hotel, and it gets expensive.
Yeah.
So it definitely has gone down in importance. I've definitely been vocal with the people at Quilt Market and trying to talk to them, like, you know, can you take the prices down? You know, we need
right
to do something to mix it up and excite people. You know, it keeps – we're going to the same kind of boring places.
Yeah.
You know, I just think it's losing its cachet, unfortunately.
Yeah. Interesting. But
it's a necessary evil, unfortunately.
Somebody told me that they didn't go 1 year. Everyone thought they were out of business, that you have to go to show you're still around. Do you feel that that's part of it as well?
I don't know.
No.
I mean, if we didn't go, everyone would still know we're in business. We have tons of sales reps and distributors out there selling our fabric.
Yeah. So only for the smaller groups.
But I could definitely see how that's definitely possible.
Yeah, yeah.
And listen, it's tough. I mean, you know, why would it be surprising if one day a company didn't show up? They went out of business. It wouldn't be that surprising.
Yeah. What about your sales reps? Tell us a little bit about sort of they go to quilt shop to quilt shop, right?
Right.
We ran into, not to yours, but a sales rep when we were at a shop doing a launch event. So tell us a little bit about the life. And I would love to, if you're willing, to chat with somebody who does that, because that's another part of the business. So that would be really interesting to learn about. So tell me a little bit about what they do.
Well, I'll give you a little bit. So listen, we use distributors in the U.S. A lot of companies use them. There's maybe 5 to 7 of them.
Yeah.
The big ones being Checker and Schenck. And then people have their own sales reps. So sales reps come in two shapes and forms. One is a multi-line rep who could carry a variety of different companies, no particular loyalty to one company, except probably the one they do the best with. And then more recently, a lot of companies started doing their own exclusive sales force. So in some cases, they pay a draw or salary and the commission, and could potentially pay for a car and insurance and things like that. So we do a little bit of both. So for Henry Glass, as I mentioned in the beginning, that's our oldest company. So we have a lot of reps who've been around a long time, really the good multi-line reps who are out there and well-known, and they see a lot of the A shops, and everyone knows them and trusts them. And Henry Glass also uses distributors. Internationally, we also use distributors as well. A lot of these different countries have distributors. We try not to have more than one distributor in a country, but once in a while that does happen. So, and then for Studio E uses U.S. distributors and international distributors, and Studio E was given to the Blank sales rep. So when we bought Blank, that was a really interesting asset for us because they had their own sales force exclusive to them, as opposed to a multi-line rep who's carrying many different lines and has no particular loyalty. So Blank, on the other hand, just uses those reps. We do not use any distributors. We just use our own reps, and it gives us a lot of flexibility because what happens with the distributors, if we say we're selling at $5 a yard, the distributors need to buy it, make a 25% markup from that number. So if our rep goes from $5 to $4.85 and the distributor hears, there's going to be a conflict. So we really have to stick to the prices. There really are no special benefits because we really need to keep the field even. So the distributors are outselling at the same price that we are, and that's how it goes. So that's where we're at now. So our Blank sales reps, we've tried to give them a bunch of different lines. We started distributing different things, air light batting. We distribute fabrics from Denmark. There's a company called Staff who was our distributor overseas that we now distribute their fabric. We distribute Cycel. Cycel sells the NCAA fabric and some other licensed fabric. There's a new company called Oasis. Two people who used to work at another company in the industry went out on their own. And that's what we're doing. So now we're kind of, I would say, like a pseudo distributor to that effect, because we're just looking to make the sales. Yeah. We want our reps to go out. We want them to sell as much as possible. We want them to make a good living and earn a lot of commissions. But while they're there, sell as much as they possibly can.
And how many of these sales reps do you think you have? Like, what does it look like?
We have around 20.
Interesting.
And we cover the whole U.S. We do Alaska and Hawaii, but it's not really huge.
Yeah.
But the main part of the U.S., you know, listen, Arizona and New Mexico are a little tougher. You know, some states are smaller, don't have as many shops. You know, somewhere like Rhode Island, maybe Vermont. But we have about 20, and we're always looking to, you know, upgrade our sales force and make sure we have the right people. You know, a lot of people retire. It's a tough job.
Yeah.
You know, they're schlepping around the weather. Yeah. You know, some of these people live in, you know, really snowy areas, really cold areas. And it takes a toll on you staying at hotels and being away from your family, being on the road.
So what's a good day if you go to if someone goes to a shop and a shop buys fabric, what's a good day for a sales rep? What does that look like?
Well, a rep could probably see two shops a day, maybe three max, depending on, you know, how long they take. You know, listen, if a rep wrote, 75 bolts in an order, you know, but you have to realize that the orders they're taking, you know, they may be for, some may be for at once, some may be for October.
Yeah.
So they're kind of all over the map. But I would say a rep would probably be happy with 50 plus bolts having left the meeting and probably worth their time, their gas, their hotel,
right,
and stuff like that. And
that's really interesting. That's hard work.
It's totally hard. I mean, they're schlepping the bags around. And listen, they're not 25-year-old kids. I mean, these are, for the most part, the reps that we have for Blank are mostly women. I would say maybe we have, I know one man for sure off the top of my head. I think another one left. I think it's only one man right now.
Interesting.
So mostly women, and what's nice about the Blank sales reps is a lot of them are quilters or pattern makers, so they really know the talk.
Yeah.
You know, whereas if I go out, you know, I know a little bit of the talk, but I don't know the talk, you know, the deep, you know, once I get past my first sentence about the fabric, then they lose me usually because I don't go that deep. Although I am going to learn how to sew soon. That doesn't mean that'll change, but maybe I'll get a little bit better.
But see, maybe that's good because, you know, you're not getting distracted by like, oh, I have to make that now. You know, maybe that's part of your success is that you've got like your a shield. All right. So we need to talk a little bit about intellectual property, if you're cool with that. So what kind of role does copyright play or trademark play in your business?
So, you know, listen, we have so many designs. You have to realize we're like last year, I think Henry Glass did 62 different lines. Wow. Studio Ian Blank did around 50 lines. Okay. So there's no way that we could copyright or trademark all those designs. The licensed lines, a lot of the licensed designers will copyright or trademark on their own, but we do not. In the few cases where we've had lawsuits, we've copyrighted or trademarked after the fact.
Yeah.
And you could still do that. And we've had cases where we've done that and won.
Yeah.
You know, because people are misappropriating our designs, and
right.
We've had a couple incidents where that happens. And
interesting.
But it would just be a whole nother business if we had to trademark or copyright. You know, I know a lot of the companies do it. I know Michael Miller does it, and I know the owner said in the past that they make more money with the lawsuits than they, you know, than other things they make money on.
Somebody said that to me. I won't say who, but somebody said that to me at Market when I was telling him about that project. I thought that was craziness, you know? That's really interesting.
Well, they're more into manufacturing.
Yeah.
We're really more about the quilt shops. They're more, they sell, they keep a lot of stock on their shelves, rolled on tubes, as opposed to cut up into the smaller, you know, 10 or 15 yard pieces.
Yeah.
And they sell a lot to manufacturers. So it's probably more present in that industry. People are making things in big quantity, you know, whether it's bags or things like that.
Got it.
So it's a bigger issue there.
So if you have that many lines, how long does a line stay in your, like, your selling area? And then what happens when you discontinue a line?
Okay, so our companies, everyone has a different method. Our method has been best is what we call one and done. Typically, we have a line. We'll release it at a quilt market. In other words, we'll release it for sale. Let's say, so I'll give you an example. So in April, in May, we have our quilt market. We'll have new lines out April 15th, which will be the ones that are really for the quilt market, but that's when we're going to start showing them. And those lines won't ship until probably 6 to 8 months later. So we pre-sell. So our reps will go out starting April 15th. They'll sell the lines, and let's say it's a December delivery. In September, I'll have to place my final order to print. So let's say by September, I have 10 different designs. I sold 1,000 yards of every SKU. I decide, hey, I'm going to buy 30% over. So I'm going to buy 1,300 yards of every SKU. It'll come in December. We ship a big chunk of the orders out right away, and then we kind of weed it down. If the line is a very popular line, we'll continue to bring it in as we see fit. But for the most part, the large majorities of the lines go in. Like the line I just said, we show it, start showing April, it ships in December. By February, March, April, the line could be totally gone.
Amazing. That's really interesting.
And then, you know, listen, it's not a perfect science. We'll always end up with, you know, 5 pieces of this, 10 pieces of that, one SKU that just went bad or they overprinted, and we'll move through it and we close it out. But we like to move. We don't fall in love with our fabric. There's always more.
Yeah.
There's always more to sell. We'd rather clean the shelves off and make money, you know, put money in our pockets and leave the fabric sitting there, you know, growing hair and dust.
Interesting.
Because that doesn't do us any good. So we're always moving.
Where is the fabric made? Is it vary depending on the company?
For the quilt shops only, the majority of the lines are done in Korea. Our cotton lines are done in Korea for the most part. And some companies use China. We do not at all. but then also we'll do some things in Pakistan. We do our wide backs in Pakistan. We do some of our less expensive white on whites and kind of more like versatile, simple fabrics there. We do a lot of our flannel in Pakistan as well. And, you know, we'll do batiks. Those are Indonesia, Thailand, but we don't do a ton of that. And then we do some business in India as well. My brother actually just got back from India. We have an agent there. That's a little bit more of the chain business we do in India.
Interesting. All right, so on one of the projects I have is, what do you expect people to be doing with the fabric? Meaning, do you think that there should be any kind of restrictive licenses like you see on fabric, like for non-commercial use or any of those things? Like, how do you feel about that in terms of, like, you buy the fabric? Do you, what are we allowed to do with your fabric?
Well, okay. I can give you a good example. I think that'll give you all the answers. So we work with Cycle. Cycle is a company that has a license for all the colleges. So they have, you know, Syracuse and Michigan and Wisconsin, and they sell the fabric. On the selvage of the fabric, it says you can't make finished products with and sell it because the NCAA probably has a license with a company that sells blankets.
Right.
So they don't want people doing that. So they limit. I know this for a fact. They in some cases they have online sellers who sell their fabric, and they won't let them sell more than a bolt or two to one customer, because that implies that they're trying to make something that they're going to sell.
Yeah.
So they'll go on every once in a while on one of these websites and place a purchase order. And if they say, I want to buy 5 bolts of this, and the machine lets them buy 5 bolts, they'll call them up and say, you know, you can't do that, and potentially even take the license away from you.
Interesting.
Right. For us, people ask. Uh-huh. People usually ask me. I usually say it's okay. I don't think many of our people who are designing the fabric are, you know, as into the licensing as an NCAA who probably has cups and pillows and pillowcases and quilts and bedding and all this other stuff.
Yeah.
And I know they spend a lot of money going after that. Actually, if you want, I could hook you up with them and you could talk to them, because I'm sure hearing from them would be better. But I know it's a cost.
Yeah.
And they have lawyers going after these people. Right.
And that makes a lot of sense. What about, like, you're just your regular, like, you make some bunny fabric? What kind of who's deciding what license goes on, and are you putting any serious restrictions on what people can do with the fabric?
We don't. We're pretty easy, but I bet some companies do.
Yeah.
Put a restriction on it. Yeah. You know, listen, a house line that we do on our own would just have the, like, so if it was a Henry Glass designer did it, would just say Henry Glass.
Yeah.
We wouldn't really limit that. If a specific designer, you know, maybe Kim Deal, if she sold, you know, cups and plates and wrapping, maybe she would tell us that you need to limit it. But I haven't really come across that. It's not a huge part for me. The most I've done with the copyright or trademark has been with people stealing the
design. The design itself. So you're okay with someone, like, you know, making hats or blankets or something and selling them on Etsy? That doesn't bother you? With your fabric?
Not really.
It's really when it gets to, like, they've bought a ton of fabric and they're competing with you in your market for fabric. Is that right? But I don't even know if that would matter, because they're still paying for the fabric, except for the licensed fabric. Like, if – I mean, it always seems
– No, I think the license is more – the companies who are licensing the fabric, they're the ones who have the bigger issue.
Yeah. Interesting.
So they put the onus on you to protect it, because – you want to keep the license. I mean, these are very profitable licenses.
Yeah. Now, the other question I have is, how do you know that if it's like – so I've seen a bunch of cases. Like, how do you know – like, I make – like, back to bunnies. Like, I'm a designer. I make a bunny design, and then some other company says I'm infringing on theirs. How do you know when you've got – like, there's no, like, book out there or, like, registry of designs, right? So how do you know when – it's all okay. Like, how do you know that there wasn't, like, you know, unconscious copying? Or how do you regulate the fabric industry in terms of design so there isn't, like, a lot of conflict?
That's a great question. I really do not – I don't know if I have an answer for you on that one. But, you know, I do know, like, when we have had trademark or copyright issues, they've said, you know, who created this design? What year was it? Do you have, you know, do you have any documentation or any proof or something like that? But there really is no way. I mean, it's really all by seeing and knowing and, you know, recognizing. You know, I came across a situation recently where a customer, a quilt shop of mine, said, hey, you know, there's a company that's selling knit dresses with your designs on them. So it turned out it was a company in China, was copying our designs and selling finished products to all different companies in the U.S., and they were selling our stuff.
And
but you know what? It wasn't even worth getting it. Like, it just wasn't worth it. We couldn't even do anything. Like, it just was – because they were overseas, there really wasn't a lot we could do. But what we did do was we advised Customs, so Customs is probably going to give them a hard time getting stuff back into the U.S.
Super interesting. That's super important part of.
But we kind of get like these things are like a lot of times they're a dead end. You know, and it's that makes it a problem. You know, because there's not a lot you could do. I mean, where how am I getting a company in China? I'm really not.
All right, so I have so many questions for you. Polka dots. Do you do a lot of polka dots? I'm doing a whole paper on polka dots and the copyrightability of polka dots, because it turns out that the courts love polka dots. Isn't that weird? There's like cases, a lot of cases on polka dots.
Well, I mean, we do polka dots. I think nowadays the problem with polka dots is everyone has them.
Yeah.
So usually when we add polka dots into a line, they'll be weak sellers.
Interesting.
Because all the shops, you know, they already
Everybody
have it.
Has like, polka dots.
Do I need to make a black and white dot on my line? I really don't. Someone
That's
has
really
it. So we've been trying to avoid that just because they haven't been selling as well as, you know, unique designs.
Yeah. Interesting. And what about batting? You've gotten into Airlite batting. Tell me a little bit about the batting industry and why you're selling it.
Well, it turned out that a couple of the blank reps had been selling that. We allow the reps to sell things that are non-fabric on their own if they want. So a bunch of them were selling it, and we spoke to the owner of Airlite, and he said, okay, we'll try that. And our reps are now selling that. Other than that, I can't tell you that much. I would be, like I said, I'd be more than glad to put you in touch with the owner of Airlite, and you could learn about batting.
Sure. Sounds good.
I don't sell a lot of batting personally. It's really more the reps are doing it. So I kind of didn't embrace it as much as I probably should have.
Yeah.
You know, but it's a competitive area.
Yeah,
definitely. A lot of people are, you know,
craziness.
Loyal to Dream and some of these other companies.
It's craziness. Yes.
There is a market. There is definitely a market for it. And, you know, it just doesn't sell as fluidly as fabric.
All right. So I want to get back to one more big question before we end. And I know we're a little over time. But so when I was looking at your websites, which I had a great It was really quite fun looking at your websites. I was at Fabric Editions, and I have one of the fabrics at Fabric Editions that I bought at Walmart that I adore. And I was super psyched to see it. So I was like, oh, I have that one. So it's super cool. And I'm someone who buys – well, first of all, I quilt every night. So I go through a lot of fabric for this project. And I'm – pretty much buy anywhere and anything. So I'm curious, like, I always get this, like, well, I mean, I totally support small shops really hugely. I love small shops. But also I like the inexpensive ones when I know I'm just doing something odd that I don't even know if I'm just going to throw it out.
Right.
So tell me, for people out there that feel uncomfortable about, like, what's the difference between buying at Walmart and buying at your local shop on the fabric level? Like, what am I getting when I go to Walmart? And I do love the feel of the fabric from the fabric shops. I do feel like sometimes there's a difference, but I don't know if it's just in my head. So can you help us? Like, a lot of people who are listening to this are also new to quilting, and so we're trying to understand what the difference is.
Well, I would say the chains do not have much goods that are printed in Korea, which is the premier place to be printing.
Got it.
They're more China and Pakistan and India.
Interesting. And
there definitely is a you know, a gray goods quality and a printing quality.
Yeah. And so, yeah. So, I don't know how to ask this question. So, why buy at the quilt shops versus the big box stores? If you're like helping people understand when they should buy where, what would you say? Like, I'm a new quilter, let's pretend, and I don't really understand. Like, is it bad to be buying at Joann's, or should I always be buying at the quilt shops? Like, I don't really, like, how do we understand
It's a bunch of things. It's personal preference. You know, listen, if you're a beginner quilter, you don't need to be going and paying $12 a yard at a quilt shop, per se.
Yeah.
It might be better to just kind of get some more bang for your buck and buy a couple yards and play around.
Yeah.
If you're advanced, you know, the Korean quality is just going to be way better.
Yeah.
And
what do you mean by that? So people always say that. I don't understand what that means. What do you mean that
it just feels better, the construction is better, the quality of the gray goods are better, and the cotton is better. Excuse me, I got a sore throat today.
Can you tell, helping my cause. Oh, I'm sorry about that. Can you tell, like, on the bolt or someplace where it's made from, so that you know what kind of quality the fabric is?
It should say on the board end. Yeah. Ours all say made in, whatever country it's made in.
And you're looking for Korea.
Yeah, Korea is typically the best. But listen, you could feel it and tell.
Yeah.
For sure.
Interesting.
You could definitely tell by the feel. And but listen, it's also personal. I mean, listen, if you're not super wealthy, and you go to Walmart often, then that's the place for you.
I have to go for a number of reasons to Walmart because there's ridiculous things in my life. But it's always like, well, if I'm going to Walmart, at least I can go by and look at the fabric. So it's like I'm not really psyched to be going to Walmart today. It's overwhelming, but at least I can go by and see if there's anything cute. So for me, it's like my little reward. But again, I buy fabric everywhere. I'm like really into. I'm like you're perfect shopper because I'll buy it everywhere. Well, cool. So it's okay to buy at Walmart. Look and see what you know, depending on what kind of thing you're doing. And why
I mean,
you're
for
doing
me, it. I just want people to buy fabric and keep sewing and keep the hobby and industry alive and you know, that's their prerogative. And listen, there are people who they may be near a Walmart and go into the Walmart. They may be near a quilt shop and go to the quilt shop. But, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be one or the other.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, and I think sewing begets more sewing. So if you're into it, so you're at Walmart, you get a scissor. Then you're at a quilt shop, you get thread and the fabric. And then, you're back at Walmart for, to get some supermarkets, some groceries. And you go, I need some backing.
Right.
It's I just want them to buy fabric. That's what the sewing revolution is about. Sewing and growing sewing and getting people back into it and getting young people into it. Because I think once you start it, it really is, you realize it is a nice hobby.
That's a great hobby. Well, this has been this hour has gone really fast, and I'm sure others will feel the same way, but I feel like I've got a little bit of a teeny tiny window into the world of fabric. And
I have many more hours for you whenever you want.
I love it. I think that would be awesome, and I really want to come visit and experience your world of fabric. So
my pleasure.
Awesome.
Anytime.
All right, well,
you come to the plant, you can come see me at Quilt Market.
Love it.
You could come. Sometimes I go and speak at Quilt Guild,
cool.
Whatever.
Awesome. Okay, cool. Well, I'm going to turn off the recording, but hang on. Don't.
Okay.
So this is Elizabeth Townsend-Gard. You've been listening to Just Want a Quilt, a research podcast coming out of Tulane University Law School. We want to hear from you. Join our army, our quilting army. Go to our Facebook page. Suggest people to be interviewed. Suggest yourself to be interviewed. We are excited to hear from you. But most importantly, I hope you get a chance to quilt today.